I'm Barbara Johnson-Stemler. I'm the Senior Manager of Access Programs here at the Sea Air and Space Museum. And I want to thank Karen Kind and Mac, and also everyone in the room for either being a model or source of inspiration to us, or just a colleague that we can reach out and talk to and brainstorm with. Because certainly none of us are in this alone. I think it takes a collective effort to do the type of work that we do. So on the screen are two photographs to give you a sense of the Intrepid Museum in case you haven't visited or you're not familiar with it. The top photograph is of the ship itself. It's in a former aircraft carrier that was built during World War II and had 31 years of service, so was serving during World War II, the Cold War, Vietnam, and was a space recovery vessel for NASA, which is why we're also a space museum. We also have the Space Shuttle Enterprise, which is in the lower photograph. So we have some really interesting spaces. We have plenty of aircraft as well that aren't in these particular photographs. The museum's mission is to promote the awareness and understanding of history, science, and service through its collections, exhibitions, and programming in order to honor our heroes, educate the public, and inspire our youth. With that, I want to talk about our Stories Within program and talk about some of the things that all of our programs have in common. Every program that's been discussed so far, there are various themes that change over time so that we try and invite these participants to come again and again, but some things do stay the same. So every program that we offer is 90 minutes long. All of our programs are free because they are funded by very generous foundations and the Department of Cultural Affairs. And every program has includes some kind of touch object or artifact, like you can see in this photograph. The participant is holding a talk tube, something that a sailor would have spoken into and would connect with the long tube to another part of the ship so that your voice can travel without a phone or a radio. It's old school technology. We have also historic photographs that we use. We have often lyrics to songs that we sing without any kind of musical accompaniment. So we are proud singers, even if we're not professional. It is not a Lincoln Center experience. And there's storytelling, which makes sense since it's called Stories Within. We use the oral histories of sailors from the ship. We use live people. So we invite former crew members or volunteers who are veterans to join the program and to speak with that first person experience about either the ship or aircraft or that time period, and to really enrich that experience and have the chance for people to ask questions and have those kinds of conversations. And of course, there are stories that are coming from the participants themselves. And I just want to give a brief shout out to Miranda, who used to work at the Intrepid Museum and was the one who actually spearheaded this program, which started in 2012, and did all the focus groups and the training and the piloting that I then was able to take and run with, and Sarah, who's also in the audience, who actually delivers these programs and develops them. So I feel very lucky to be the one speaking. In terms of our challenges, and we miss Ed.
Yeah. He
passed away. Yeah. Some challenges that we face. Some are very specific to our museum, and some are probably things that everyone experiences. The Intrepid Museum is an immersive, historic environment, which is amazing, but also challenging in the sense that people can become confused if they forget where they are, because they suddenly find themselves in a steel ship, and are we going someplace? They see airplanes. Are they about to fly somewhere? So trying to either build in that reassurance into the programming and, you know, casually mentioning that we're at a museum and we can see this historic aircraft, or just being able to reassure someone if they become agitated or anxious. It's a steel ship, as I mentioned, so the acoustics can be challenging. It's also a fairly popular museum. We see 1 million visitors a year, so there are times when it's very crowded. We're also open 7 days a week, so having to navigate those spaces can be challenging. It's also an enormous space, so the ship itself is 900 feet long. And so when we're planning our program and our route, we're always trying to anticipate the kind of transition time. So we're only looking at two or three places that we're physically going to stop, but how much time does it take to get from one place to another? We have a multi-sensory exhibit called the Kamikaze Experience, and that happens hourly at the museum, where we have basically a recreation of a kamikaze attack. So there's sirens, and there's fog machine, and there's lots of loud noises, and we avoid it. And so that obviously has to be something that we plan for. And if, for whatever reason, someone encounters it, and we're trying to avoid that, we then have to deal with the impact of that experience. Again, the sirens with the general quarters sound can be very upsetting if someone doesn't realize that it's a recreation, it's a video. Some other challenges that we have are just our physical location. We're located at Pier 86, which is West 46th Street and 12th Avenue, which is very difficult to get to with public transportation. And we also have a lot of outdoor elements. We have a flight deck, we have a pier. So we are very sensitive to weather. Today was a hot day. Therefore, we try to create programs that happen in the spring and in the fall when we have a higher chance of having pleasant weather. But what we find is that having that break of programming and then a hiatus and then programming and then a hiatus can often cause a fluctuation of participation numbers. So we have people who come back again and again, and then people who might come for those spring programs, and then we never see them again because we sort of lost touch. And there are so many fantastic programs in the city that, not that we're competing, but that we might sort of not be top of mind for family or professional caregiver. Also, one of our challenges or just realities is that there are so many amazing programs happening, like Meet Me at MoMA, that are based in art museums that we've had to adapt and modify our strategies and our teaching techniques. We have needed to sort of find our own way and to create a balance between providing historical context and facts with more open-ended storytelling. And we are still sort of experimenting. It's been many years, and we still are trying to try new approaches. I think certainly having a former crew member be there at the program with the group has been incredibly powerful. That can't always happen, so we're still trying to see how we can have that creative, open-ended element while also knowing that there are specific facts about this aircraft or the arrestor cable that is being held in that photo. We also have been experimenting with how we use those historic photographs. We try to not only use photographs from the collection of the ship and the sailors, but also popular culture. So ways, entry points that people can connect with if they're more familiar with the popular singer or athlete of that time period, and how we can relate that then to Intrepid and the stories from the ship. And again, sort of how those sing-along songs have helped us sort of get people in the mood or sort of paint a better picture of what those sailors might have been listening to while they were doing something else and sort of making those connections. And then finally, because this is fun, we've been experimenting with dance. And so for a few years, we've had a USO dance, this idea that if the troops were being entertained in this fashion, perhaps our participants would like to do that as well. So we have period music playing, we have swing dancing, we have usually a song that we sing together, And we invite lots of other staff members at the museum to join us for this dance. And we find that it's a really powerful way to get more buy-in from other, from our colleagues. We do some dress up, and it's just a fun time all around. Anecdotally, we see a number of participants who are veterans and who are attracted to our program and our museum because of their military experience. And we have found that by tapping into long-term memory, some of those associations are very positive and some are not. And we're still learning sort of strategies and ways to validate and listen to those stories and be with them in that moment, while also being very mindful of the full group experience and knowing how to navigate those conversations. And finally, I just was inspired by Lindsay's presentation about disposable income and how it sounded like 25% of New Yorkers or of those older adults are receiving SNAP benefits, because the museum just recently became the first New York museum to participate in Museums for All, which means that anyone with an EBT or SNAP card can get free admission to the museum. So we're very excited not only to have these free programs, but to be able to invite anyone who receives that benefit to come back to the museum for free and hopefully extend that experience and that opportunity to see our collection and participate in a larger community. And I think build in that reassurance into the programming and, you know, casually mentioning that we're at a museum and we can see this historic aircraft, or just being able to reassure someone if they become agitated or anxious. It's a steel ship, as I mentioned, so the acoustics can be challenging. It's also a fairly popular museum. We see 1 million visitors a year, so there are times when it's very crowded. We're also open 7 days a week, so having to navigate those spaces can be challenging. It's also an enormous space, so the ship itself is 900 feet long, and so when we're planning our program and our route, we're always trying to anticipate the kind of transition time, so we're only looking at two or three places that we're physically going to stop, but how much time does it take to get from one place to another? We have a multi-sensory exhibit called the Kamikaze Experience, and that happens hourly at the museum, where we have basically a recreation of a kamikaze attack. So there's sirens, and there's fog machine, and there's lots of either build in that reassurance into the programming and, you know, casually mentioning that we're at a museum and we can see this historic aircraft, or just being able to reassure someone if they become agitated or anxious. It's a steel ship, as I mentioned, so the acoustics can be challenging. It's also a fairly popular museum. We see 1 million visitors a year, so there are times when it's very crowded. We're also open 7 days a week, so having to navigate those spaces can be challenging. It's also an enormous space, so the ship itself is 900 feet long, and so when we're planning our program and our route, we're always trying to anticipate the kind of transition time, so we're only looking at two or three places that we're physically going to stop, but how much time does it take to get from one place to another? We have a multi-sensory exhibit called the Kamikaze Experience, and that happens hourly at the museum, where we have basically a recreation of a kamikaze attack. So there's sirens, and there's fog machine, and there's lots of loud noises, and we avoid it. We avoid it. And so that obviously has to be something that we plan for. And if, for whatever reason, someone encounters it, and we're trying to avoid that, we then have to deal with the impact of that experience. Again, the sirens with the general quarters sound can be very upsetting. If someone doesn't realize that it's a recreation, it's a video. Some other challenges that we have are just our physical location. We're located at Pier 86, which is West 46th Street and 12th Avenue, which is very difficult to get to with public transportation. And we also have a lot of outdoor elements. We have a flight deck, we have a pier. So we are very sensitive to weather. Today was a hot day. And therefore we try to create programs that happen in the spring and in the fall when we have a higher chance of having pleasant weather. But what we find is that having that break of programming and then a hiatus and then programming and then a hiatus can often cause a fluctuation of participation numbers. So we have people who come back again and again, and then people who might come for this, those spring programs, and then we never see them again because we sort of lost touch. And there are so many fantastic programs in the city that, not that we're competing, but that we might sort of not be top of mind for the, for that family or professional caregiver. Also, one of our challenges or just realities is that there are so many amazing programs happening, like maybe at MoMA, that are based in art museums that we've had to adapt and modify our strategies and our teaching techniques. We have needed to sort of find our own way and to create a balance between providing historical context and facts with more open-ended storytelling. And we are still sort of experimenting. It's been many years, and we still are trying to try new approaches. I think certainly having a former crew member be there at the program with the group has been incredibly powerful. That can't always happen, so we're still trying to see how we can have that creative, open-ended element while also knowing that there are specific facts about this aircraft or the arrestor cable that is being held in that photo. We also have been experimenting with how we use those historic photographs. We try to not only use photographs from the collection of the ship and the sailors, but also popular culture. So ways, entry points that people can connect with if they're more familiar with the popular singer or athlete of that time period, and how we can relate that then to Intrepid and the stories from the ship. And again, sort of how those sing-along songs have helped us sort of get people in the mood or sort of paint a better picture of what those sailors might have been listening to while they were doing something else and sort of making those connections. And then finally, this is fun. We've been experimenting with dance. And so for a few years, we've had a USO dance, this idea that if the troops were being entertained in this fashion, perhaps our participants would like to do that as well. So we have period music playing, we have swing dancing, we have usually a song that we sing together, and we invite lots of other staff members at the museum to join us for this dance. And we find that it's a really powerful way to get more buy-in from our colleagues. We do some dress up, and it's just a fun time all around. Anecdotally, we see a number of participants who are veterans and who are attracted to our program and our museum because of their military experience. And we have found that by tapping into long-term memory, some of those associations are very positive and some are not. And we're still learning sort of strategies and ways to validate and listen to those stories and be with them in that moment, while also being very mindful of the full group experience and knowing how to navigate those conversations. And finally, I just was inspired by Lindsay's presentation about disposable income and how it sounded like 25% of New Yorkers or of those older adults are receiving SNAP benefits, because the museum just recently became the first New York museum to participate in Museums for All, which means that anyone with an EBT or SNAP card can get free admission to the museum. So we're very excited not only to have these free programs, but to be able to invite anyone who receives that benefit to come back to the museum for free and hopefully extend that experience and that opportunity to see our collection and participate in a larger community. Thank you.
program, even though she brought her on several years ago. So it's a whole situation where you're having to basically educate the person who brought you on, who hired you to do this program, to say, this is why we've been partners for several years, and I'm going to tell you again and again and again. And then that person, we're hoping, will be bought in enough to go through to the decision makers. One suggestion was to go to the development office and say, it comes down to money. You know, it comes down to the bottom line. So this is where this audience is not being served at this particular institution. There may be inroads or avenues that you can take with caregivers or family members of these people who are coming through your doors to look for funding resources. Mm-hmm. So that was one suggestion.
Yeah.
One thing that I just thought of here when Mrs. Sarah that was speaking about the issues with staff, and I think it dawned on me that training for dealing with people with dementia is something that all museums should make sure their front of house staff is aware of, because guess what? 65% of people with dementia are undiagnosed. So they're encountering these people, whether they know it or not, whether they're in these groups. So, it could be individual visitors, not people coming to these programs. And, when I was first starting our program at the Met Cloisters, I had, what was then, Alzheimer's disease, train some staff in certain areas and had our two security managers. But, I'm thinking there should be something for every security person. There should be something for everyone in visitor services.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is, from a public health point of view, this is also where there's a ripple effect, right?
Yeah.
To just educate the public. Because when they see it in their family,
oh, sure,
they might be less afraid.
Yeah.
Or there are just so many. I know. I think they may be less afraid,
yeah,
once they have some familiarity and they,
sure,
and they know some people with dementia, and therefore perhaps they'll take that person to the doctor instead of just ignoring it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that rate of diagnosis can potentially be improved.
Oh, I just wanted to say, I'm from Canada, and I don't know if you have this here, but our medic alert bracelets that people buy,
yeah,
that they're blue, so that professionals like ambulance drivers and policemen can recognize without even having to verbally engage.
Mm.
They see that it's a blue one,
mm,
and then they know that person has a form of dementia.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's something.
Yeah.
We actually, as a matter of fact, we have a representative here at Caring Kind that is, whose sole role is to help with that process of applying for medical alert wanderers safety bracelets and necklaces identification. So if you know of anyone or someone comes to your programs and says, I've heard of this. But it's not this kind of a bright, color-coded thing, right? It's not an instant recognition. You have to read it to know if,
yeah,
it's because you need to avoid penicillin,
yeah,
or because you're encountering a,
yeah,
person
it's
with dementia,
for kind of health issues,
yeah,
in general. The other thing I wanted to say, also a shameless plug, is training for front of house staff or general staff. That's something I've done for the Queen's Museum where I met Oliver. I've done it with a couple of institutions who are represented in the room. So if you have interest, that's something that we can talk about. Because it is a mentality, a holistic mentality, where you have, as Leslie said, people walking into through your doors who may not present themselves or self-identify themselves as having dementia or any other kind of cognitive impairment. But you want to, the idea of the training is to make people in the front of house more sensitive to. So, last words. Any other comments? Fantastic. Thank you for coming. Before you leave, two things. I want to make sure that we have your signed media release, because we have videotaped this, although I'm not on the video right now. And also to fill out the evaluation that is also on the outside table. And thank you very much, and take some food with you.
Thank you.